Last week, we discussed the historian Michel Foucault and his ideas about madness as a cultural construction. This week, I would like to discuss Pierre Bourdieu. He's a French sociologist of culture. He's around the same age as Foucault, and he has quite some things in common, actually, with Foucault. But that will be for later in this podcast. Let me say a few words first about the discipline of sociology, because so far we have never been talking about sociology. During the 19th century, the word sociology was introduced for the very first time. A big influence on the first usage of the term was how the French philosopher Auguste Comte used it. Comte was a philosopher living in the early 19th century. He was born in 1798 and he died in 1857. Now, Comte argued that the historical evolution of mankind could be studied just as precisely and scientifically as the physical or chemical properties of a given material. That was the inspiration for the closer study of human societies and their history in a more precise and scientific way, which is what we still call sociology today. Let me give you the dictionary definition of the term, and it is, I quote from the Oxford English Dictionary now, the study of the development, structure, and functioning of human society. End of quote. But it's useful to add a sentence which comes from Wikipedia and which says that sociology is a social science that uses various methods of empirical investigation and critical analysis. That means sociologists today see themselves as social scientists. In earlier times, before the 19th century, most historians or other intellectuals working in what we would call the social sciences today saw themselves first and foremost as storytellers, not scientists. This changed with Auguste Comte. Comte divided history into three major phases: the theological phase, the metaphysical phase, and the positivist phase. In this linear evolution, he recognized the increasing importance of rationalism. In the beginning, humankind had to appeal to divine forces to explain reality because the power of human reason was not yet strong enough to explain things in terms of rational factors. Hence, this phase he designates as the theological phases. Then, in the next phase, these forces lost their theological reference and they became abstract forces, such as nature or reason. This is what Comte calls the metaphysical phase. And finally, through scientific observation and experiment, humanity finds that the abstract forces are actually social laws, which can be understood and manipulated. This is called the positive phase by Comte. Understanding this evolution, Comte believed, would help to remedy social ills. It was no coincidence that the 19th century was also the time when the public awareness of such ills, such as alcoholism, poverty, and crime, sharply increased. But Comte never adequately answered the question whether and how the scientific method could be transferred from the physicist laboratory to the actual social reality studied by the sociologist. While it is possible to isolate chemical substances or natural phenomena and conduct experiments on them in a laboratory, this is much more difficult when it comes to people. It is just impossible to put a whole city in a laboratory. Also, scientists want to be able to isolate variables, and this is very difficult in social reality. What changes, for instance, in the social structure when people live closer together or live further apart, when they live organized according to family or when they live organized according to clan? What is the impact of different levels of education? What is the impact of an increase of poverty or a reduction of poverty? As a scientist, you want to control all other variables and then see the evolution of the single variable you're changing. But of course, this is simply impossible when you're dealing with social realities. So, which method do you have to choose in sociology in order for it to become a real science? The task of providing sociology with a solid methodology came to the successors of Auguste Comte. Initially, the field remained strongly theoretically oriented. The early sociologists such as Emil Durkheim and Marcel Mauss made as much use as possible of observations from non-Western cultures. For instance, let's have a look at Marcel Mauss. When he wrote his extensive article, The Gift, in French it's called Essai sur le Don, in 1923 and 1924, he included as many descriptions of gift-giving from as many different cultures as possible. Examples in his essay ranged from reciprocity in ancient Scandinavian cultures to the potlatch celebrations of various Indian peoples. From mid-20th century onwards, sociology increasingly came under the influence of a quantitative methodology. This means that sociologists were devising new ways to eliminate the subjective opinions of the researcher, including his or her prejudices. They did so, for example, by using surveys that were worded as neutral as possible, which were linked, moreover, to objectifiable statistical data, such as age, gender, origin, education level, and income. That's all I wanted to say giving you some context on the term sociology. Now let's have a look at specifically the sociology of culture. Sociologists of culture believe that social background is decisive for the function of culture. Let me go over a few of the early sociologists of culture first. The current meaning of the word culture goes back at least 150 years. It first appeared in 842 with the writings of Gustav Friedrich Klemm. Klemm is an interesting figure. He was a German ethnographer and he was an avid collector of non-Western artifacts imported from the European colonies. Working as a royal librarian, Klemm was confronted with the problem of cataloging the so-called primitive cultural objects from the overseas provinces. Being a 19th century European, he was unable to consider these objects as art. He simply refused them the status of art. For Klemm, non-Western art objects did not fit the regular categories that he was accustomed to using. They had mixed and very different functions. An object could simultaneously have a religious meaning, a utilitarian value, and an artistic value. That was very different from European 19th century culture, in which an object either belonged to the household, was a useful object, or it belonged to the fine arts, or it belonged to religion. And the hybrids were very strictly delimited, like a painting being an art object that also had a religious meaning. But these hybrids were strictly delimited, and this was not the case with the exotic objects that came into Europe under colonialism. And because Klemm was not able or not willing to classify such objects as fine art, his solution was to use a different and much broader label. That's how he arrived at the title of his 10-volume work. It's called General Cultural History of Mankind, Allgemeine Kulturgeschichte der Menschheit. For Klemm, the label cultural history could entail all external forms of a certain society: its social organization, its etiquette, its technology, its utensils, its art, its religion. But Klemm's solution also raised a number of problems, in particular the problem of Eurocentric prejudice. Collecting information about different cultures is what makes them comparable. But Klemm's comparisons were informed by a denigrating and racist attitude. He distinguished between active cultures, such as that of the Germanic people, not coincidentally his own culture, and passive cultures, such as those of sub-Saharan Africa. And such ideas like those of Klemm became increasingly popular at the end of the 19th century. They became known under the name social Darwinism. Social Darwinists believed that it was possible to apply the theory of evolution to the human species. Moreover, they wanted to control that evolution, for example, by privileging certain races, peoples, or cultures. Eventually, this movement would have pernicious consequences during the first half of the 20th century, most markedly under the form of the Nazi regime. Other early definitions of culture had similar shortcomings, like the one of Klemm. Karl Marx was another 19th century founder of the social sciences, and he also had a rather limited view of culture. For Marx, cultural products always expressed the underlying economical positions. If you wanted to understand the religion of a certain people, of a certain culture, of a certain society, I mean, you first had to understand who controlled the means of production of that society. Culture, in his view, was little more than the justification of that social structure through various images and stories. Now, the thinker we are going to look at today, Pierre Bourdieu, has a quite different and much more nuanced view. He builds further on the ideas of Auguste Comte, of Karl Marx, but he takes a much more, his view is much more complex. He is a 20th century sociologist, and he is known as the founder of quantitative cultural sociology. Amongst other things, he did a large-scale study of the cultural preferences of different social classes in post-war France. But let me tell you a few things about his biography first. I think it's useful that we get to know the person Pierre Bourdieu first before we get into his ideas. So, Pierre Bourdieu was born in the south of France, on the countryside, as the son of a postal worker. He left that environment in 1948. On the advice of a teacher who had noticed his talent, he went to a boarding school in Paris. That was the famous Lycée Louis le Grand, the Louis le Grand Lyceum or high school, and was seen this school as the ideal preparation for the highly selective entrance exam of the École Normale Supérieure. Also, Foucault was a student there, as you might remember from the previous episode of this podcast. Bourdieu passed the exam, and at the school, at the ENS, he mainly studied philosophy. Under the influence of his teacher, Georges Canguilhem, the young Bourdieu took a special interest in the history and philosophy of science. It was a stronger attraction to him than the rather fashionable existentialism of Jean-Paul Sartre, which was very popular during the 1950s. Thanks to Canguilhem, Bourdieu received a teaching position at a lycée near Paris after his studies. However, he still had to fulfill his military service. He did so in the year 1955, and he was sent to Algeria in the north of Africa. Algeria in that time was still a colony of France, and the country was at that time suffering from a bloody war between, on the one hand side, the Algerian Liberation Front, FLN, Front de Libération Nationale, and on the other hand, the French army. In Algeria was quite special as a colony because the European colonial presence was exceptionally large. It was in that sense very much unlike other European colonies. Think of Belgian Congo, for instance. Belgian Congo never numbered more than 90,000 Belgians. On the other hand, in French Algeria, there were more than 1 million French citizens. They were known as the colons, as the colonists, and they were actually quite had a quite important role to play in the very bloody resolution of this conflict during the mid-1950s. Bourdieu stayed in Algeria had a profound influence on him as a young man. It also changed the direction of his early career. The great systems of the philosophers of the past became less interesting to him. They seemed for him quite unsuitable to understand the world of today. He began to develop a stronger interest for social and economic structures. Without a real academic background in the social sciences, he started his own research. He did his first field work in the Berber region of Kabylia. After his years of military service, the subject continued to fascinate him, and he stayed in Algeria, and it led to the publication of his first book in 1958, called Sociology of Algeria, Sociologie de l'Algérie. In that book, he described, among other things, how traditional agriculture and the associated forms of social organization were being threatened by the rise of wage labor and the emergence of an urban working class. Bourdieu returned to France during the 1960s. He began teaching at the University of Paris and Lille, and then afterwards at the École Pratique des Hautes Études, a famous institute, today still, for higher education and research in the social sciences. Bourdieu started to shift his field of work to that of the sociology of culture. That transformation started in 1965 with the publication of an extensive study on the social use of photography under the title A Middlebrow Art, un art moyen, Essai sur les usages sociaux de la photographie. In 1979, he published his most famous work on the relationship between social status and culture, and that book is called Distinction in English. In French, it's called La Distinction. Bourdieu argued that our cultural preferences are not neutral choices, but that they strongly correlate with class and with social status. Later, during the 1980s, he completed his research project in cultural sociology with the study of the structures of the literary field, and the resulting book is called The Rules of Art, Les Règles de l'Art, from 1992. From the 1970s, Bourdieu's work enjoyed considerable interest in France and abroad. In 1981, this reputation was cemented with his appointment as holder of the Chair of Sociology at the prestigious Collège de France, the same institution where Michel Foucault was also teaching. Still, his activities were not limited to the academic world. He also presented himself as a public intellectual, taking an unambiguous political position. Together with his colleague at the Collège de France, Michel Foucault, he expressed his support for the Polish trade union, Solidarność. That organization, the Polish trade union, demanded more self-determination for Poland in regard to Soviet Russia. This is the time of the Cold War still. In the winter of 1995, Bourdieu lent his voice to the French strikers who protested against the plans of Prime Minister Alain Juppé to cut pensions and social security. That plan provided for, among other things, an increase in hospital costs. Following that strike, he was the co-organizer of the States General of the Social Movement, Les États Généraux du Mouvement Social. Again and again, he criticized the advance of neoliberalism and the dismantling of the welfare state. In the year 2002, finally, Pierre Bourdieu died from the effects of lung cancer. That's enough for his biography, I believe. Let's have a look at his work. As a sociologist, Bourdieu looks at cultural preferences, including art, including language, which he sees as expressions of a person's social position. For example, it is not because all of us speak English that we all do it in the same way, or that we always use the same English. You might note that the kind of English I'm speaking now, I'm trying to sound a little bit BBC-ish, as you might. I'm trying to sound quite British because I associate a British accent in English with an academic usage, a school usage of English. If I would talk English to someone I'm just encountering in the street, or if I'm imitating a character from a movie, it's a totally different type of English. There are significant differences in the language being used depending on the context in which one finds oneself. How a student addresses a teacher at school is different from the language that student might use in a text message to friends. And this language is again different from the language the student might use with his parents or in a sports club. One of Bourdieu's most important points is that the use of those different language variants determine whether or not you can function in a particular social context. Those who wish to obtain a diploma at university, for instance, will have to learn the academic language. Otherwise, you cannot participate credibly in a classroom discussion or as the author of a scientific paper. You must have the appropriate academic language competencies. The same also applies to other domains. I cannot use academic language on the football stand. That would be equally inappropriate as using the language of sports in a classroom. Using the right language shows my familiarity, for instance, with football as a cultural phenomenon. The rules of the game, the history of the sport, the local competition. That knowledge is a form of cultural competence. In football, I need other skills than I need at the golf club, or at the opera, or in the museum for fine arts. If I lack that competence, a game of football or a visit to the museum becomes meaningless to me. I am reduced to a superficial evaluation of the cultural phenomenon. For example, I can only say that the player is built athletical or not, that the painting was painted finely or not, or that the piece of music sounds cheerful or solemn. I will not get any further without using the right code. Let me quote Bourdieu on this. A work of art has meaning and interest only for someone who possesses the cultural competence, that is, the code into which it is encoded. A beholder who lacks the specific code feels lost in a chaos of sounds and rhythms, colors and lines, without rhyme or reason. Not having learned to adopt the adequate disposition, he stops short at what Urban Panofsky calls the sensible properties, perceiving a skin as downy, or lacework as delicate, or at the emotional resonances aroused by these properties, referring to austere colors or a joyful melody. End of quote. Which competences I have depends on my own choices, but especially on my social status and my class. The environment in which I grew up determines whether I am accustomed to the social interactions of the golf club or those of the football canteen. According to Bourdieu, these options were definitely mutually exclusive. He saw social class as an unambiguous determinant of cultural preferences. That's where we might have a different opinion today. But this explains the title of his book, Distinction. Culture is a very recognizable form of social distinction between people belonging to different classes. Class-related preferences form a coherent and readable system. It includes the visual arts, music, film, TV, sports, interior decoration, food, fashion, dance, and so on. Bourdieu groups all those cultural preferences we pick up during our education under the header of the habitus of a certain social class. Let me say a few more words about that notion of habitus. A habitus designates ingrained habits, skills, and dispositions. It is the way that individuals perceive the social world around them and how they react to it. And these dispositions are usually shared by people with similar backgrounds. Think of social class, religion, nationality, ethnicity, education, profession. In post-war France, which was the social reality studied by Bourdieu, it was undoubtedly true that there was little overlap between golfers and football fans. And that difference was strongly related to social status. Whether it's still the case today is subject to doubt. I think that class is still determinant for culture, cultural preferences, but not as strongly as Bourdieu believed it was. In any case, social differences have not disappeared. But whether they still lead to such unambiguously different cultural expressions is another question. Today's successful businessman likes to frequent the golf club as well as the VIP area of popular sports such as cycling or football. The set of cultural competences that I possess constitutes my cultural capital. Now, by introducing this new term, cultural capital, Bourdieu signaled that he placed cultural preferences at the same level as other forms of capital. So, what you get from your upbringing is not only material resources, financial capital, or practical skills, professional skills, expertise, hence economic capital, or connections, that's social capital, but also cultural capital. Cultural capital is that which allows you to fit in with a certain social class. Cultural practices are related to class and to educational level. That is the irrefutable conclusion that Bourdieu draws from his large-scale research into the cultural practices of post-war France. He had collected sufficient quantitative material to show that taste was positively correlated with class. For example, the data showed a fundamental distinction between the taste of office employees and that of shop clerks. But that does not mean that everyone is aware of, let alone accepts, the determination of cultural preferences by social class. What's more, in our contemporary society, you are expected to present your own taste as an individual choice. We make a strong connection between our own personality and our choices for a particular taste in music, visual arts, and literature. Bourdieu had also noticed that tendency. He called it the ideology of charisma, we tend to see cultural preferences as natural characteristics of individuals. And that, for him, according to him, was an illusion. Now, let me explain to you how these cultural competences and cultural preferences are passed on, how we are trained in them. And there, the notion of institutionalization is important. Our society, says Bourdieu, has many different mechanisms to pass on financial, economic, and social capital. Growing up almost always goes together with what sociologists call the socialization of the child. This means that as a child, you quickly learn what behavior is required in different social contexts. Analogous mechanisms exist to pass on cultural capital. Education in particular plays an important role in teaching cultural competences. Again, let me quote Bourdieu on this. The family and the school function as sites in which the competences deemed necessary at a given time are constituted by usage itself and, simultaneously, as sites in which the price of those competences is determined, namely, as markets which, by their positive or negative sanctions, evaluate performance, reinforcing what is acceptable, discouraging what is not. Now, the social mechanism behind education is the legitimation of certain cultural phenomena by institutions. Examples of such institutions are the school, the university, the museum, or the gallery. They determine which forms of culture are worth preserving and passing on, and which ones are not. That process is called canonization. Canonization also determines how cultural products are ranked. Following Bourdieu's analysis, the terms lowbrow, middlebrow, and highbrow found quicker adoption. This corresponds more or less to the terms popular culture, middle-class culture, and high culture. For example, consider which subjects are deemed acceptable within popular or lowbrow photography and within artistic or highbrow photography. Bourdieu and his colleagues presented photos with very different subjects to their test audience. They found that people with a low level of education readily approved of images such as sunsets, natural panoramas, or communion parties. The higher the level of education, the more disapproval for these photos. These photos were then dismissed by people of higher level of education as corny or trivial or even vulgar. On the other side, there was more disapproval among the lower educated for photographs with banal and meaningless objects, such as a metal frame or a piece of tree bark or the window of a butcher shop. The subjects were found to be misplaced or inappropriate for a photograph. The higher the level of education, the more people recognized these pictures as legitimate photographs. Bourdieu explained that this was because the higher educated group recognized the cultural references, such as the reference to a painting by Rembrandt in the photo of a butcher shop. A different example is the theatre. Popular or lowbrow theatre embraces chronological storylines that develop in a logical fashion. The characters and situations are easily recognizable. The public of such performances expect to be able to identify with what is happening on the stage. They expect to experience a feeling of immediacy. And the same trend you may recognize in other forms of popular entertainment, such as sports or musical or blockbuster movies. Highbrow theater, on the other hand, includes ambiguous and symbolic situations and characters. The story might be absurd. The public often experiences alienation. The makers use meta-theatre, such as the performance of a play within a play, in order to avoid identification. The spectator, in other words, feels a distance from what is happening on the stage. A legitimate user of highbrow culture not only appreciates this, but he or she also knows the correct way to appreciate. Let me turn to the visual arts for an example. Take the famous work Fountain by Marcel Duchamp from 1917. For the culturally ignorant, it represents little more than a urinal. But for those who possess cultural competences in the field of contemporary art, they will be able to recognize it as a legitimate work of art, and they will be able to explain which statement Duchamp wanted to make about the art world. he or she will also be able to connect it to the notion of avant-garde art, to the introduction of ready-mades, and so on. The task of the sociologist is to expose such mechanisms. Bourdieu illustrates this with two very different theatre reviews, each of which makes a comment on the value of nudity on the theatrical stage. And the first review is about naked ballerinas in an opera show. The second review is about the naked performers from a musical, namely the famous musical Hair, performed for the first time in 1967. The first review states that nudity in a ballet can never be vulgar. The second review, however, dismisses the so-called commercial use of nudity as something that can never have a real artistic character, because it simply aims at cheap thrills. Each of the reviewers, says Bourdieu, saw the same kind of phenomenon, namely nudity on the stage, but their evaluations deviate, because ballet is highbrow and musical is lowbrow. And that brings us to the end of this week's podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it. I hope it was more or less understandable to you. Please make sure to read the accompanying chapter in the book, have a look at the slides, and then do the test. So I hope to see you again, well, as a figure of speech, next week. In the meanwhile, all the best, stay safe, stay healthy, and goodbye.